This is the Roaring Elephant Podcast, and here I am with my solidly platformed co-host, Jon. Hello, Jon.
Okay, the only platform thing I can assign to humans is platform souls, so you think I'm short?
How about platform games?
Oh, that's another one, but this is a serious podcast. We don't talk about gaming at all.
Okay, there we go. That's our other podcast. Anyway, the platform connection today is platform engineering. And once more, following on from last week's Open Tofu episode, we have Corey O'Daniel continuing to join us. And we now pivot into conversations around platform engineering. What is it? What has it been? What has it developed into? What are the thoughts for its future? And many, many other interesting directions. So to talk about a slightly different topic, you've mentioned the term kind of platform engineering a number of times. And like, obviously, kind of DevOps engineers, SREs, that sort of thing. Like for those that don't know what platform engineering is, how do you describe that?
If you had asked me a year ago, I would have given you a crisp and concise answer. a full year into like the hardcore rebranding that's going on, I feel like we've ended up in the exact same place DevOps was, which is no one can define it anymore, and it means something totally different depending on what organization you work in. I think that the best definition of it is essentially making your DevOps efforts a product within your organization, and there's a certain scale that makes sense. Right now, the catch is with that is there aren't enough people to go around to do the ops work that we need. Right, look at how many companies are understaffed in their ops department or under budgeted in their ops department, and then you scale that out to everybody that is becoming a software company and then trying to move their stuff to the cloud. Right, we don't have enough ops people, and you see it every year in the Stack Overflow surveys. Like that number is going down compared to the number of software developers. Right, wow. the relative people with cloud experiences is diverging from the number of people that are writing software. That's a problem. That's a big problem. My wife yesterday, she was like, we get a breach notice almost every week now. And it's like, yeah, we do. It's because people are fucking out there guessing in production, right? Like we need to have better practices. But again, like ops people, we don't have budget. We're overstaffed. Like we walk in day one, like 7 years of debt built up. It's really hard. And I think the efforts of platform engineering, that idea of taking a really great DevOps team and turning them into a product that engineers can self-serve is like, that is the chef's kiss definition of where you wanted to get to. That is so hard to get to, yeah. Right? And like, that's where tools like MassDriver kind of come in. It's like, we want to get that platform engineering experience down to the teams that are sitting at like level one or level two of DevOps maturity, where they're like, I would love to adopt infrastructure as code, but like, I just don't have the time, right? Adopting infrastructure as code is not just writing some HCL. It's cataloging your cloud and figuring out what you have, where it is, who owns it, what's production, what's not, what's something somebody forgot about and we don't need anymore. Getting that into some infrastructure as code, organizing that infrastructure as code, getting in some CI pipelines, getting some policy tools. There's so much stuff to do to just take that first good step, right? Most teams can't get there, right? And so we're trying to bring that just perfect idea of platform engineering closer to the people that really, really need it. They can't get the operational maturity to get there. Now, what is platform engineering? I meet platform engineers every day on sales calls, and I'll tell you what, no one knows. We're right back to where it is. So there's so many teams that have just been rebranded. It's yeah. Like, I'm a platform engineer. It's like, oh, cool. Like, what do you guys do? Are you building your own platform? Are you using Backstage? And they're like, we manage the VMs with Ansible. And it's like, oh, so you're. And they're like, yeah, we're the DevOps team. They gave us all $20,000 raises and changed their title. And it's like, okay, gotcha.
Good for them.
Right? And that's where we've ended up, right? Like there's people like, well, we meet people that are like, I'm a platform engineer and they're doing very like 2012-ish, like big corp ops stuff, right? They're managing VMs with Ansible, right? There's other people that are like, oh, we're platform engineers and they run the services that run their Backstage install or whatever, right? We meet other people that are like, we're platform engineers and we're actively building it, right? And then you meet other people and they're like, oh, we're platform engineers and they kind of are just like that, literally that DevOps role, not the DevOps culture that you've kind of seen in the past few years. It's just, they've literally just rebranded the team. And I think that sucks. That sucks that we got here, because the thing that I saw, the biggest benefit of platform engineering that I saw last year was not just the work that we're trying to do and some of our competitors are trying to do to kind of make operations more accessible and give people better postures from day one. The biggest benefit I saw in platform engineering was that people were getting excited about the word, right? Mm. And I think that this happens a lot where people are like, oh, you're using a buzzword. And it's particularly engineering, right? It's buzzword bullshit. But this word showing up gave us an opportunity and we fucking squandered it.
Mm.
It gave us the opportunity that business people, people outside of IT, people outside of engineering are hearing this word, right? Budgets are showing up. Hey, we got to do this platform engineering thing. We heard it makes operations teams more efficient. Our engineers are always complaining about how slow ops is. They're a bottleneck. Ah, they're in their way. Ops is the devil, right? Like, and people are getting excited about platform engineering. And then we as a community didn't do the work again. We didn't do it with DevOps. People got excited about DevOps and then we kind of never really defined it. We let everybody kind of run their separate ways with it. There's DevOps roles, there's DevOps culture, there's DevOps person, right? We had this marketing opportunity where everybody is excited about the word and they still are, but we're not doing the work we should have done with DevOps 10 years ago, right? We should have been, as engineers, epic at marketing and telling people within our org that we're doing it wrong and what we need to do, right? There's people that don't know how to do the work that are excited about the term and willing to put money and our time into it. We can't just keep doing the same job and saying, thanks for the title change. We have to push back. We have to say, look, if this is an initiative that outside of engineering is bought into, and the amount of times I've met a customer where they're like, our CIO wants us to do this, or the CISO says it's important, and if they have some stakeholder day one, it's like, dude, you have a stakeholder. Grab onto that and just take advantage of it. Like, get the work done. If they push back, or they tell you you're moving fast enough, or they want you to do it in this old opsy way, push back. Like, do the right work. And that's where I think we squandered this. So what is the definition of it now? A lot of people are seeing it as just a rebrand. I'm hoping it is us taking the next step and making people's operational posture a bit better.
Yeah.
But time will tell, man. We just got, like, I'm honestly concerned now just with how many people I met at reInvent last year that was a rebranded DevOps role, that this is just going to be another kind of bullshit title is my biggest worry. It happened with SRE. Like, the idea behind SRE is great. And so many SREs that I meet are, they're a QA person, right? Or they're help desk, but they call them an SRE. And it's like, there's words for that. And you can be a QA person. You can be a help desk person. You can be a support person. There's nothing wrong with that. Your role is important. But kind of getting confused about what the thing is and changing a title and then never doing the work, it just creates ambiguity. Like, I don't even think you could go apply for a platform engineer job and understand what you're going to be doing.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. And that happened with DevOps. It happened with SRE. Yep. It's happening with platform engineering right now.
Yeah.
It's a bit of, the companies have problems, and instead of solving the problems, they just give people a different name, and now the problem is solved because hype told them that if you have DevOps engineers and SREs, that solves all your problems. So let's, your SREs now fixed.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny. Like, I mean, there's two ways that you see, like, platform engineering kind of happen in orgs. There's like the person. There's the person in the operations role, that cloud engineer who's like, I got to figure out how to make my team more efficient because there's only three of us and there's 300 software developers. That spark of what can I do proactively versus a ticket that's filed in, you know, GitHub Actions, or a ticket that's filed in, you know, Change Now or whatever garbage tool you're using that you think sock to you, right? Ops guys, I got you. I know, it's all bullshit. But like, not just waiting for somebody to say, hey, I need a database in prod, like, starting to go out and, like, doing the work, like, what is the thing operationally or cloud-wise that is slowing down the majority of my engineers, right? And your first platform engineering initiative might be something dumb, like increasing your build times by switching to a different Docker build tool, or, you know, just going through and giving people, you got a company where 80% of your services are Node, like, give them a consistent CI/CD pipeline for that so they're not thinking through it constantly. Like, reusable workflows and GitHub Actions. Like, there's really basic things that you can do. Mm. But when you're productionalizing yourself and thinking of yourself as somebody who is supporting this engineering team, like that is that first step. And if you can do that and then go to your boss and say, hey, we started to take this initiative. This is something I just wanted to do. I want to see if I can make things better. Talk to engineers about what their biggest problem was. I found it, right? You've got the MVP startup mentality about it. I think that's one of the key things to really pulling it off. I found the problem. I fixed it. Here's the numbers. I want to start investing more into this platform, which might just be CI/CD now. It might just be a CLI tool. It might be, maybe it's a sweet web service. Maybe it's got a GUI on it like MassDriver. Who knows? But I think that the ground up, that's where you see the most success. If you can maintain it, man, because I'll tell you what, as an ops person, like you've got 80 hours of work to do in your 40 hours, and deciding to do this is going to cause you to have 120 hours of work in your 40 hours. But a month from now, you're going to be working 32 hours a week. You're going to be hitting a half day Fridays, right? The other way is this outside stakeholder, right? And that's where most people are kind of coming from in these bigger organizations. There's a stakeholder that's heard the word. They were on a panel someplace and they're like, we got to do platform engineering. And in that case, you kind of got to take your team that's going to be responsible for it, and you got to strategize on how to take advantage of that stakeholder's stake that they've placed in the thing. Because at the end of the day, if they just change your title and they gave you a pay bump, right? And the CISO's like, hey, we need to do platform engineering. That's going to solve so much of our problems. If I change your title and give you a raise, I did it. Now it's just this platform engineering team kind of sucks.
Yeah.
Right? Like, check.
Yeah.
I rolled out the platform engineering initiative. Like, they just didn't do a good job at it, right? Yeah. Like, and that's, and who suffers? Your entire organization.
Yeah. You mentioned at the start.
It honestly really resonates.
Yeah, sadly, really resonates with what I've seen. But you mentioned at the start the number of people like in this kind of operation space is like steadily declining. Number of developers like hugely increasing. This kind of gulf widening and widening. Like, I can guess, but what do you think is kind of causing this kind of phenomenon to kind of continue to worsen year after year?
Yeah, so I think it's kind of twofold. So one is, and there, I want to be straight up with this because somebody was like, "Hey, last time I said something like this." I love people that go to boot camps. I think it's great. If you're 18 and you're going to a boot camp, I might not know what I'm getting out of you. We have an engineer on our team went to a boot camp. One of the best engineers I've worked with. Don't poach him. I'll come after you. I'll come after you both. right. Boot camp grads are great. And when I meet a boot camp grad, there was a guy I worked with about a decade ago. He was a power plant engineer in his 40s, and then decided one day, I want to do software. Like that right there, like that is a person I can work with, right? Like somebody who has dedicated their life to a job and then realized, like, I played around with this idea. I really liked it. I'm going to quit what I've done for 20 years and go spend 16 weeks learning how to do that. That is an awesome person. They might not have a CS degree, but they've got like the gumption. They've got the initiative, right? Mm. So there's nothing wrong with boot camp engineers. I think it is a need that we have. Too much stuff is becoming software. We need more people to write software. Yeah. It takes too long for them to come out of a university. And when you come out of a university, you don't necessarily have real world views of the world. Somebody who has a worthless computer science degree where I learned all my computer science stuff actually working someplace, right? And so we're making a ton of people out of boot camps, though. So that's the first problem, right? That's the big rift, right? When you look at, you know, the Stack Overflow surveys, the amount of people that are responding, the amount of engineers, we have 27 million software engineers on the planet today. That's more people that are in Australia. Like, that's a whole continent of software developers, which is a weird continent. So we're making, right? So we're just like, we're making these people. There's up and to the right, I guess it's this way. Sorry, I think my camera's backwards, right? We're making these people, but at the same time, we're teaching them Rails. We're teaching them React. We're teaching them things that businesses need. Businesses need fucking ops, right? And so there's a couple of ops boot camps out there. There's a couple, a buddy of mine runs a company called Cloud Posse. It's kind of like a boot camp-esque thing that like attaches to your business. There's a couple of boot camps that are now just doing ops tracks, and there's a couple of universities that are starting to teach some ops stuff, although I have thoughts about that, right? We need more people to know ops in the cloud. And the thing with the university is they're going to teach you how to use fucking Mesos or something like that from 10 years ago.
I didn't
we need Mesos. More people to- I know, but like, you know, like, it was like they're teaching Java 3 still. Right. And so we need more people with this expertise. And so the unfortunate bit is we're making all these software engineers, right? This number's going up, but most people learn cloud and operations by being in prod, right? Like, you don't learn scale. You don't learn, security attack surfaces. You don't learn, just dealing with tons of traffic, weird outages in college. You don't learn about that in 16 weeks at a boot camp. You learn about that your first week on, where somebody's like, hey, this service that you've never worked on before is broken. Why? And then you go and try to figure out why. And like, that's how we teach people ops. At the beginning, it's broken, right? And so that's kind of the problem. Is like, we don't have a great way of doing this. And I don't think, like, while I think these boot camps are going to be interesting, they're going to teach you Kubernetes in 16 weeks, or they're going to teach you Terraform and AWS EC2 in 16 mm-hmm. weeks, right? Like, that's hard to teach in 16 weeks. It's easier if they're coming in and looking at what your company is doing and kind of acting like a consultant and guiding you, but there's not a lot of companies that do that, and it can get expensive, right? And so how do we teach all these people that are learning to write software and doing a great job building the thing that a business needs, something they can click on, something I can buy? How do we teach them ops? Yeah. I think the way you do that is, unfortunately, it falls on the ops people, right? Like, if there's three of me and there's 300 software developers, I want 30 ops people, but we don't have a budget for it, right? So this is unfortunately going to fall on me now. Do I want to start some sort of apprentice program within our organization to start teaching some of these other software developers, like, how to think DevOps, how to do some of this stuff themselves, not just build it, but also how they can run it, right? Like, that, I think, is the only realistic way of kind of getting this education out there, besides just waiting for people to figure it out and prod. But again, we're right back to the, I've only got 40 hours in a work week. Like, when am I going to stop to teach all these software developers some of these practices and find the ones that are interested in it and like start to bring them over to the dark side?
Yeah, but it's kind of inevitable, right? Because I think personally that something's went wrong in the last 20, 30 years. When I was young, that's a long time ago, it was normal to go to a company just with your basic school knowledge, basis knowledge. You knew you're never going to use it, but at least you had a basis to build upon. But you went as an apprenticeship or whatever in a company to start learning the real world.
Yeah.
Today, if you look at any job posting out there, you need to be an expert in all the fields and teach them how to do it. There's so little companies that still want to put the effort in actually putting time apart, because you're right, 80 hours, 40-hour week. You need to give your people slots to mentor, to help new people, to make them know what they're doing in the real world. But in a world where everything is governed by stockholders and need to be double revenue every single quarter, there's no space for that. So I like when you say we should do some apprenticing in our company, perhaps, because I think that's really missing these days. But how do you do that in a world where it's so there's so little leeway?
Yeah. And it's funny because like, companies know that they need more ops people, but it's like, are you going to invest in an apprenticeship program? And there was a great book, I think it was by somebody at Thoughtbot, the company that was like big in the Rails space, called Apprenticeship Patterns. There's a great book that focuses more on software side, but like, there's nothing to say you couldn't kind of take those same philosophies and roll them out at org. Now, again, you need that stakeholder who's going to say, hey, it's fine for us to spend some ops time doing this. But I think like, that's the way you get it. When you go back to like, I don't know if we're the same age, because I've used an absolute crap load of Botox, so I'm a bit older than I look. Sorry, I live in Los Angeles, we're vain. But like, right, when you look at how we operated software 20 years ago, right, you're a LAMP stack engineer, right? Like, you had Linux and Apache and MySQL and PHP in your name, right? The PHP Lambo boys are all like, yeah, bring back the LAMP. But it was easier 20 years ago to run our software, right? It's so funny, like, we think of the cloud, but like, the cloud has made it so easy. Well, the cloud hasn't made it easy. The cloud's made it more complicated, more expensive, and the cloud kind of likes to, you know, I feel like, make us all feel like we're too dumb to run our own stuff, right? Mm-hmm. But like, back in the day, it was Linux, but the world was so much simpler back then, right?
Yeah.
Like, the DevOps is Bullshit article that I wrote, there's a follow-up article to that called Elephant in the Cloud, where I kind of talk through a bit of like how our lives have changed and like why this ops gap is such a big deal. You go back 20 years, I got Linux on my laptop. We're running Linux on a VM, right? We're actually probably running Linux on actual metal. We go back far enough, we weren't even using VMs yet. And all of a sudden, like, VMs start to become popular, and you see like the Slice hosts of the world pop up. You're like, oh, I don't have to have metal anymore. I can get my little Linux thing and they'll do it for me. Great. Operationally, something changed about, but it wasn't much. We're still just pushing stuff over SSH to a machine. Mm-hmm. And then a few years after 2004, 2006, 2008, serverless shows up. And we're like, oh, this is a different way of running our software. I don't have to think about machines anymore. This is great. I like it. So people start doing that. And now you got businesses that are like a little bit VMs, a little bit serverless. They're doing a couple of things. A few years past, we got Mesos. We get Kubernetes. Containers are a big deal. Well, now we're putting stuff in containers. So now it's like we got VMs, we have Metal, we have Lambdas, we have containers. Now we have serverless containers. And now we have serverless Kubernetes, right? And now, like, right. And so while not much has changed about how we write software, right? That's why they can still teach C in college 600 years later, right? Like, it's ifs, it's variables, it's loops. It might look different from one language to the other, but it's like generally the same. But the way that we've run our software has significantly changed five times in the past 20 years, right? And so like, that's a part of the problem. And that's the baseline of the problem. So it's like going into any company, I don't know how they run stuff now. I hope that more people kind of adopt Kubernetes. My Kubernetes fanboyism isn't because it's a new shiny tool, it's because we can have like groupthink on, I want groupthink on how we run stuff. Like, I don't want to walk into an org and they're like, haha, we've pulled together all this random shit. And it's like, okay, great. I would love to learn that and then not be able to take those skills to my next job, right? Like portable skills, that's what I want. Like, that's how we close this gap, is starting to do things and operate things the same way. And so the way that we've run our software has changed, and that's a problem as far as ops goes, because you don't know what you're going to get into at a job. You don't know how they're going to run things. You've got to kind of learn to run it five different ways, depending on maybe even the team that you're talking to.
Yeah.
Like, front end team's going to write some Lambda stuff. But then our apps changed. And I think this is where like the big gap really started to rip. And I think the pain started to show up. It's one thing to run your app five different ways. It's a different thing when your app is now composed of the cloud. Right.
Yeah.
So previously, I'd have a background worker and I'd do some stuff in the background, but now I'm doing event-driven systems. So I need SQS and SNS and IAM. And so now my job as a software developer just got a little bit of this cloud engineer stuff tossed on top. Right. And so now I need to understand how IAM works. I need to understand how some base level cloud stuff works. But again, if we teach that in school, we're teaching, here's how you do it on AWS.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And so like, again, like it just gets hard, right? Without doing some deep apprenticeship at organizations with operations engineers, like, I don't know how we scale this. I don't think doing a boot camp's going to do it. A college program's not going to do it. It's going to help a little bit, but it's not going to close this rift that we're making right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I wonder how much of this is also down to, like, frankly, like, everyone and their dog out there knows that, you can become a developer, you can go and build software, and you can go and do cool things. But I'm drawing parallels to, you know, I spent over 20 years in solutions engineering, pre-sales, that sort of world. And that is one of those things that I think, a little bit like platform engineering, no one really knows that what that is. No one really knows what that world is. And it's one of those things that you kind of fall into, or you find, or you see someone doing that thing and you think, oh, that's cool. Like, how can I go and do that? And I think that platform engineering has a lot of that kind of energy to it as well, in that it's just, it's something that organizations know that they desperately need, but like there's not a lot of, like, you know, formal, whether it's formal qualifications, boot camps, like just publicity about platform engineering. Yeah, there's like a few kind of people drinking the Kool-Aid and thinking, right, now I've got to go and do this platform engineering or implement this platform engineering thing. And, you know, as you said earlier, like, give people new job titles, 20K raises, and think they've done it. But I think until you can get to that point where you've got that real groundswell of people wanting to come into the world of platform engineering, there's always going to be that delta. And, you know, unless you can figure out a way to essentially like publicize like the huge impact that platform engineering can have on an organization and get it front and center in people's minds. Like, hey, this would be cool. This would be something that I really interest. Like, I love solving these kind of problems. Like that's the kind of thing that will at least help close the gap in terms of the people. But what it won't do, to your point, is help with the challenges that are continuing to widen in terms of the technology. Because I genuinely don't know like where we go from here in terms of the rapidly increasing complexity and also the rapidly increasing speed of change as well. Because, you know, earlier on in your description, you compressed kind of 25-ish years into about 5 minutes, which I thought was excellent, by the way. But you know, when if you think all the way back to LampStack, you know, that was the first major step, and that was a major step up from where we just had a thing and we just run it, and it all lives in that big blob. And you know, the LampStack was seen as like, hey, this is. We're splitting these things out into these separate components. Wow, this is crazy. And yet, you know, you fast forward to where we are now, and you've got, you know, massive distributed microservices mixed in with serverless, mixed in with this, mixed in with that, and like it's all so massively complicated, and it's not getting any simpler. Like it's continuing to get more complicated, and the speed of this is increasing. That. I mean, I definitely don't envy the kind of the world of people that are going to be kind of trying to make sense of this, you know, another 5 years, another 10 years from now. Like it's already pretty damn complicated to figure out, yeah, what the hell's going on with stuff.
It is. I mean, and that's one of the things that's funny. It's like, I feel like, you know, I was just having this conversation with my co-founder yesterday, like, not to be a Ruby engineer, but like so much, it's funny because people like dog on Ruby all the time. Oh, it's slow, whatever. It's like, yeah, your code's slow. It's not Ruby. but like, if you look at like Ruby, it was always like Rails was always this idea of like convention over configuration. And we never got that was like kind of, I feel like groundbreaking in releasing a product. I have no code today. I can have a product up in a couple of days with Rails, right? That's very, I mean, it's very hard to do with any other tool, except for maybe like some of the frameworks that have kind of like very much stayed with that, right? But in ops, we don't do convention over configuration. Everything about the way my company does things is so absolutely unique. Like, I dare not do what you do. I must do it my way, right? Like, and however we ended up there, whether that's like our own just personal opinion that we need to do it this way, or whether, you know, the onslaught of services that we're running now like deem it necessary, right? Like, we don't have that convention,
yeah, in
the operations side of the world, which I think is one of the problems. I think the other problem is the monolith versus microservices holy war that you see on social media constantly. Like the amount of times I'll log into Twitter and it's like, monoliths are trending for you, and it's like, no, they're not. But like, it's funny because it's like, oh, which one should you do? And it's like, you should do both. You should be a responsible person, maybe a developer who's like yearning for that engineer title, right? Like, let's be engineers about it and do the responsible right thing for our software, not do the thing that somebody said to do, right? Like that, yeah, to me, and the engineer versus not engineer debate is going about your work with responsibility, yeah, and accountability, right? And so looking at something and being like, we only do monoliths. It's like, well, you're not, that's an irresponsible decision. Saying we only do microservices, that's an irresponsible decision. Making the right decision for your software, I think, is one of the things that makes simplicity and convention possible. And so when we start thinking about like, okay, we have a monolith, or we're going to start with microservices, that person's dumb, right? Starting with a monolith is a great place to start, but don't just die with the monolith. Like, you need to find when it makes sense to start spinning out these services, right? And I think that if you could go back in time and make the right decisions for your business through its entire history, we wouldn't have this problem. But unfortunately, like, you're in the moment, right? And I think one of the things that's also hard is like this, I have a monolith. Should I break it out into 30 services? Should I swap this out with an AWS service? Like, that is a very operational conversation. And a lot of organizations keep their ops and dev still separate. They do DevOps because this person's called DevOps, but it's very much that it's that pre-Flickr, like, I'm over here doing my job, you're over here doing your job. Like, we got to work together to figure this out. And it's funny, like, not to dog on anybody at Uber, because I don't think I know anybody who works there, but there was this paper that came out, or blog post from Uber, where they're like, we have 3,000 microservices and it's a nightmare. And we collapsed it all down into these 7. And everybody was like, oh, Uber went away from microservices. And it's like, no, Uber discovered domain-driven design is what they did, right? Like, that. I don't think they say it in there, but it's just like, hey, we kind of just fucking winged shit for a while and broke everything apart. And then we had to bring it all together because it was insane, right? And it's like that right there, like going about something not to get it on domain-driven design soapbox, but like that's one of those things that I feel like I wish they taught in school. Because I think that mindset, when you're working on an application, understanding that I don't just have a lib folder with a bunch of code in it. I have different domains of my business, and I'm going to have the word user 3 or 4 times, and that's fine. I don't need to jam it into a God model, right? Like, if we were just better about like thinking about the business versus just writing code for a product manager, right? Thinking about the organization, that's our job. And we don't get enough time to do that job because we're constantly rushed through things. But that's one of those places where I think we need to push back. We need to spend more time thinking about our systems. Once we get into a place where we understand our monolith, we can say, okay, you know what? There's a security constraint around this part that dictates that this should be a separate service. Let's move it out. Or this is such a hot path or important path, like checkout. It can't go down. The platform is changing constantly, but we don't ever want checkout down. I need to break that off into its own service because there's a financial impact of this thing being up and ready, right? Making business decisions around when to break stuff apart versus just saying, oh, we're building something new. That Rails app sucks. I'm going to go write this in Node so I can play with something new. And now I've got myself a microservice. And that's where many organizations kind of end up. And I think you can have that same fun you get with like building a microservice, thinking through how to refactor your applications into these blobs of domains that make sense, and then figuring out when to bring those things out. And when you bring that out, make it a service. But like just jumping to one of these like day one, I think is one of the things that helps create that massive complexity that we have. And that's unfortunately where many people are, because they think it's a war between like, is it a monolith or is it microservices? And the answer is neither of them are right. It's understanding your business, understanding that your job as a software engineer is to model that business, not just write code. And I think if we start doing that, and if you're doing that, you're going to have a much healthier cloud presence and more easier to understand cloud presence.
Yeah,
but this definitely comes back to the training thing, right? You need people that have the domain knowledge, the real world domain knowledge, to be able to make those decisions properly. And in my experience, typically it's a CTO that read a book on this is how you do it, and that's how you're going to do it, and you don't think, you do what I say.
Yeah.
And then you get these fantastical things being built.
Have you guys read the Big Blue Book, the domain-driven design book, the Jazz cover? You know what I'm talking about? The ugliest.
No.
It's the most hideous book in the world. It is an amazing book. And it's domain-driven design. I can't remember the guy's name, but when you see the cover and you think blue and jazz, like you'll find it. it's a great book. And I think like that should be a book that every university should be including, probably right after your introduction to software, is like starting to think about it as this isn't right. I think the unfortunate thing, I don't know that there's a ton of jobs outside of sports and art that end up this way, but like our job also happens to be a lot of our hobby. Right. And I think that's what makes it hard and makes it suck a bit is like, hey, I like writing code. And it's like, no, our job isn't to write code. Our job is to model a business and make them money. Right. That's it. Oh my gosh. I love that. You wouldn't believe me if I told you that. That book sits by my bedside every night. You may or may not believe me on that one. But.
It's bookmarked. Thank you.
It's too expensive though. They got to bring that down. Is that inflation or is that just hardcover price?
That's a hardcover price.
Oh my gosh. Ah, nobody's got $74 to learn something.
But the first link I found was one that you could apparently read it online. So
it's old. I mean, it's like, I think it's like written, like they use like Java as an example. That's one of the fun things though, is like looking at examples in other code and not just copying and pasting them, but like doing it in the language that you know, something I've always kind of found fun with books, but anywho.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I know that we're heading up towards time at the moment, but it's been great chatting with you, Corey. You mentioned a couple of times the company MassDriver and your co-founded it. But like, tell us a little bit about it. What's the deal with MassDriver, and if folks are interested, how can they get hold of you?
Yeah, so there's two buttons right there. You go to massdriver.cloud first, and then you can either hit that Let's Talk button and you'll talk to me about your woes, and I'll pretty much be like a psychiatrist for your ops people. They can kind of cry on my shoulder. It's okay, I understand. Or you can just hit get started and start playing with it. So what we are, we're effectively an internal developer platform, very similar to Backstage, Port, all these things you see out there. But our philosophy about how to get there is, I think, fundamentally different, right? So platform engineering is important. If we can scale operational talent, we can deliver more secure systems. Like, that is our goal. I don't want my wife to get it, but hey, I got a breach notice again. I don't want that to happen ever again. And you know what? I have so many Experian credit monitoring freebies. I don't need it anymore. Think of something else. Send me an Apple. I don't care. I've already got one from the person that was breached last week, right? Like, we want to get more secure, stable systems. It shouldn't be something that only the most elite organizations have. Like, there's very small companies that this stuff really matters to, but they struggle with ops, right? You meet I'm not going to call out any customers in particular, but we have a lot of people in the healthcare space. Mm. I'm pretty sure we can all agree that keeping healthcare information secure is extremely important, right?
Yep.
You know how hard it is to get an operations person or a seasoned DevOps person, SRE, a platform engineer, to go join a healthcare company? It's very hard. They don't have budget for it. Software is not always the most exciting thing you're going to be working on. And that same person can go work at Google and make 400 grand a year, right? Like, so how do you get the talent there, right? And like, these are the kind of people that we're helping scale whatever operations talent they have, whether they have an ops person or not. And so what's fundamentally different about us is we're pushing that self-service, we're pushing that DevX, but nobody on your team has to learn anything new. And that's kind of our philosophy. So the way it works under the hood is, if you have ops engineers, they use the tooling that they're familiar with. They can write Terraform or OpenTofu or Bicep or CloudFormation or Helm, whatever. They just use the tools that they know. They take your company's policies, practices, whatever, and they essentially design Terraform modules that they want their engineers to use. And then they just publish it into our registry. Their job's done. And what's nice is the maintenance burden is done too. If you have, let's say you push a Postgres module up, and it's got your Chekhov and your OPA policies in there, right? Well, if you do that today and you're like, hey, here's a Terraform repo, grab what you need, your engineers aren't going to grab all the shit. They're going to miss some of the CI pipeline. They're going to bug you about stuff, right? And then inevitably, if you have 15 databases deployed and you change the version of Terraform or the Chekhov policies, you have to go find it. What's nice with MassDriver is your policies and your run books are bound to your Terraform module or your Helm chart. So when I push that out here and say, this is how we run Postgres, all that stuff comes with it. So if I say, hey, we have to update the version of the AWS provider for this module, I do it in one place. I put my Chekhov policies in there. I publish it into the registry. I don't have to hunt down 45 engineers that are running it. They're going to get it next time they deploy. And now for the engineers, what sucks, like when you're rolling out DevOps or, you know, infrastructure management engineers, is they have to learn Terraform. They probably don't want to. they have to learn some level of the cloud, which they may want to, but they probably don't have time to, right? And when you think about how we think about Terraform as ops people, there's so many attributes of a resource that your developers don't give a shit about. Your developers want to set the version of Postgres. They don't care about your zonal replication. They want to set that Postgres has so much RAM. They don't care what the instance class is, right? And so what's nice about the platform is we kind of suggest that people change the way they think about their Terraform, their IAC a bit, and think about just exposing the variables that their developers care about and handle all the other stuff behind the scenes. And so now what happens in MassDriver, once your module's published up there, you haven't changed the tooling that you've used as an ops person. We suggest that you change your philosophy a bit, but you don't have to. You push it up, and now when your engineers need Postgres, I'm making a new service, or I need SQS because we need to do some evented stuff, I just drag SQS out, or I drag Postgres out onto my canvas. I draw my infrastructure together. I deploy the picture that I'm looking at. I got to work in pictures, which is what I did on the whiteboard, which is what I'm going to go do in Lucid Charts when I'm done, except for I didn't use a whiteboard and I didn't use Lucid Charts. I just drew it and it happened. And all the provisioning is using your Terraform, Helm, Ansible, Bicep. You can actually move, put them all together. So if you're like halfway between Chef and Terraform, like you can have, for your developers, it's just one canvas. But if it's Chef in this module and, you know, Terraform in this module and Helm in this module, they didn't have to learn any of your tooling. And so you're essentially giving them this filtered down view of the cloud where you're exposing just enough attributes that they care about. They're getting ClickOps. You might be thinking, well, we're trying to do GitOps. Your developers don't give a shit about GitOps. And I can prove it. You did GitOps, but you bought a drift detection tool. Why did you do that? Because they didn't like GitOps. And they went into the AWS console and they clicked some shit anyway. And now you're buying a drift detection tool. Like, they want to click stuff. That's what they want to do. Like, they want to write code. And when they don't understand something, they want to go into something that makes them feel a bit safe. And then they want to get right back to writing their code. Right. And so you just draw it. And as an operations person, I know my guardrails are there. I know they're not naming things weird. I know my tags are in place. And they didn't have to learn Terraform. They didn't have to go learn about AWS RDS. They got to think about it as Postgres, which is what they know. It's what they brew installed. Yay, everyone's happy. So nice. That's my pitch. So.
Nice. No, all good. All good. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Corey. It's been really, really interesting chatting with you about a whole variety of different topics. And look forward to perhaps catching up with you again in the future.
Yeah. You guys going to be at KubeCon?
Not this time, but okay. Maybe next time.
Yeah, we'll be at KubeCon, so swing by our booth. We're also the sponsors for Open Tofu Day, so we'll have some very sweet swag if you want to get one of those little shiny box stickers.
Nice. Awesome.
Tofu stickers. It's on a box.
Fantastic. Well, again, really appreciate your time, Corey. It's been great chatting with you. And all the best.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you. And that's it for the second and sadly final part of our time with Corey. I hope everybody enjoyed the discussions around platform engineering as much as I did. I mean, there's the thing to be said about just relabeling things, and that typically doesn't solve things, weird enough. It was great to have somebody as enthusiastic as Corey on to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, and knowledgeable. Very, very deeply experienced in this. I loved his... 25 years condensed into about 45 seconds explanation of tech. We've done, I think, probably somewhere like 7 or so episodes when we covered that same point. So that was kind of fun.
Yeah, but too much condensing is bad for podcasting. That's just how it works. I mean,
That's true.
Anyway, big thank you to Corey. And unless you have anything else to add.
Nothing else from me.
Then that is all the time we have for today. You can become a patron. You can support this podcast via Patreon contributions. So help us keep this running and get good guests like Corey on the show. So please support us that way. We are on YouTube. If you're not looking at us there, then you can't see us, which is logical. But you can also like, subscribe, hit notification bells there. You can also still go to our website at www.roaringalpha.org. There's links there to the Patreon page, YouTube page, and other information about the podcast. And any feedback you may have, you can send by email to podcast@roaringelephant.org. Until next time, my name is, I'm not too short, Jon.
And my name is, this platform is the perfect height, Dave.
And we look forward to talking to you again, without Corey, sadly, next week.
See you then.